Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is the response of the day for the 27th of Cheshvan. Today we're going to discuss a tshuva of Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel at the just before and at the beginning of the State of Israel. This is from his Shul Heichal Yitzchak from the Eben HaEzer section, volume 2, response 81. So one of the interesting things about Rav Herzog, and we've noticed it before in other tshuvot, but it comes up here as well, is how much of his time was spent on issues of agunot, of women who either were or had a danger of being required to stay unmarried because of problems with finding their husband, or their husband was lost in the Holocaust, and he dealt with a lot with those kinds of issues. We've seen that before. We saw a tshuva of his about what to do about helping women avoid the problem of their husbands go off to war and go missing in action at war, and issues like that. So it's interesting to remember that there are names of people, and we might not encounter them in halachic context because, thank God, we don't have those halachic contexts, but who spent, you know, full lives working hard and helping other people in halachic ways that we don't ever know about. So that's one of the things about Rav Herzog that I've come to learn over the course of this project, is that was perhaps an outsized part of the job that he did over the course of his life. So in this case, he was being asked, this is from the 27th of Cheshvan of Tufshin Zion, 1946, the fall of 1946. He was asked about, so this is right after World War II, he's asked about a woman who was Zikuka Liyibum. She, in other words, her husband, her first husband, passed away without any children. And in the situation where a woman's husband passes away without any children, she's supposed to Yibum or Chalitza with his brother. Yibum would be marrying the brother. We generally don't do that anymore. And Chalitza would be a ceremony by which the brother says he's not interested in marrying her, and therefore she can go her own way. So this was a woman who needed to have that, meaning her first husband passed away without any children. There was a brother who she could have married, but she didn't know it. We're going to find out about that in the course of the tshuva, course of the responsum. And so she instead married another guy. She got married, and now she's pregnant. So the Yabam, her former brother-in-law, the brother of the man who passed away, lives in Israel, and she lives in Holland. And so the question is, what's the halacha? So there is a seemingly a clear rabbinic halacha that she's required to get divorced from the man to whom she's currently married, then get a chalitza, and then she can't marry that first husband, and she has to marry some other guy after all this is over. But we'd prefer not to have that happen, right? And the question is, if she requires a chalitza from the Abam, can you wait until after she gives birth? And the reason why that's the question is because if you wait until after she gives birth, because right now she's so pregnant that her traveling to Israel seems to be problematic for her. It's not clear that it's safe and for her and for the baby to travel. And the general practice is that when there's a yabam in one place, the man who needs to do the chalitza, the brother of the deceased, is in one place, and the woman who would like the chalitza to be able to get married to other people is in another place. The general practice is that the woman is the one who travels to the man, but he or she can't really travel, so the question is, can they wait? So, Rav Herzog starts off by saying, I'm going to do my best to see if I can get a way to get the brother to come to visit her, to get a flight to Holland. And even though she's really supposed to theoretically come to here, since she can't, try to convince him and try to arrange the visas and try to work it out that he can get there. Now, if this is pre-state Israel, that means his coming back to Israel may or may not have been a problem. So there was paperwork there that had to be done. So when he says, I'm going to do my best, he means, I'm not sure I can work this out because of the bureaucratic issues around this, but I'm going to try to help out by doing that. And it's not right, he says, to wait until after the birth, because meanwhile, if we're going to leave her now, if we're going to tell her she has to divorce her husband, which she's going to try not to do, but if we were going to tell her she has to divorce her current husband, then you would say, yes, so wait, what's the big deal? But really, she's living with a husband right now. We're going to be trying to work our way to let her continue living with this husband. But if that's true, until she has a chalitza, that will be be'isr. She's not really allowed to stay with this husband until that point. So that's why Rav Herzog is going to try to get the Abam, the brother-in-law, on a flight to Holland. Because halachically, by the simple halach, if you just casually looked at Sifrei Psak of the Shulchan Aruch, you would have said that they need to split up from each other until the Yabam has a chance to give her to perform a chalitza. So the question becomes, there's two questions. One question is going to be about her, and one question is going to be about the baby. The question about her is, what's her status with her husband? And then what's going to be the status? So in other words, the Shulchan Aruch in heaven, Ezra Kuf Nun Tet Seif Bet, in 159, paragraph 2, says that if a woman who needed chalitza or yibum got married to somebody else, somebody outside the family, even if she did it b'shogeg, even if she did not realize what she was doing, the halacha, the way the Shulchan Aruch paskins is, she has to get a divorce, a get from her current husband, and the Shulchan Aruch says, even if they had children. And she can't get married to him ever again. She never said, Alav. And she can't get married to the Yabam because she's sort of been married to somebody else in between. So she needs a chalitza. But the Vlad, the baby, is not considered a mamzer. And then the other people say, this is all Shulchan Aruch still, other people who say that it's a mamzer derabbanan, that rabbinically they made the child a mamzer as well. And this was all as a way to strengthen the need, the people's recognition, and we're going to get to that issue, that people had lost track of the fact that there is such a thing as Yibum and Chalitza. They may have thought that that was something for a long time ago, but they didn't pay attention to it so much anymore. And Chazal wanted to make sure people didn't think that way about it and didn't lose track of it. So they made all these stringencies. One was that the child's going to be a Mamzer from the second marriage because it's as if, as Mamzer Derabbanan, he's going to be illegitimate at a rabbinic level because it's as if the mother, who was Zikuka Liabam, she needed to have a yibum or a chalitza, so Chazal wanted to make sure that she understood that was a serious need, and therefore they instituted that the baby, if she married somebody wrongly, the baby would be considered a mamzer derabbanan, and then the yabam would give her a chalitza, and then afterwards she can marry other people. That's the Psak and Shulchan Aruch. That's the simple understanding of the Talmudic sugyot and of the halacha. We're going to get to possible leniencies that some Rishonim had along the way, but that would be the simple thing. That would seem to say that she's stuck. And that's all part of, so this, before we even get into how Rav Hirsch is going to find a way around it, it's just something I think always worth noticing, that Chazal, when they needed something to be well understood and well accepted, they wanted people to understand this was serious, they made serious consequences to violating the law, and this was an example of it. Meaning, if everything was, you know, it was perfect about the situation, there was no reason to think that there were extenuating circumstances here, even shogeg, even her not realizing she wasn't supposed to do it, is not good enough to avoid the child being a mamzer derabbanan, to avoid her needing to divorce this husband and get a chalitza and not marry the yabam, and then having to go find some other person, other man to marry. So Rav Herzog says, though, v'afa pichein, even though that's true, it's incumbent upon us liftoach lehatzala v'limso heter shitisha eretz al ba'ala l'achashit t'chlot yabama. Yeah, it's our obligation to find a way to help her out and let her stay with her new husband, because it's just a mess to like force her to get divorced, and the child's going to have this stigma to him or her, right? Be a mamzer derabbanan. It's just a terrible thing, and so therefore he's looking for ways to give a heter. So I would just point out, without in any way questioning Rav Herzog's instincts in this situation, that in some sense he's saying, yeah, there's halacha, but we have to do something different than the halacha. That's always an interesting thing to watch, because then you're saying that either circumstances have changed. That's basically what he's going to say. He's going to say the circumstances are so different now that he doesn't think that this decree of Chazal about a woman who marries without having gotten a yibum or a chalitza is the same circumstance as it used to be, and that's going to be fundamental to his avenue of leniency. So that's an argument to be made, but then you always have to think about, when is it really different, when is it not really different? And these are, I think, underlying issues that, to me, always come up, or come up very, very often, and have to be dealt with and have to be grappled with. So, one avenue of leniency is the Bahag held. So the Bahag is a very important geonic source, the Baal Halachot Gedolot. It's an early halachic work, one of the earliest halachic works that we have post-Talmudic, meaning that took halacha from the Talmud and codified it, and just told us what the halacha was. A very important work, the Bahag. He's actually the reason why, if we miss the day of counting Sfira, there's a lot of things that he's the reason for, but he is the reason that if we miss the day of counting Sfira, we then count afterwards without a bracha, even though really the vast majority of opinion was that if you miss a day, you can still count all the other days with a bracha. He held that you couldn't, and therefore, in deference to him, we don't count with the bracha. He held you couldn't count at all, I think. So in deference to him, we don't count with the bracha. So here he held that if she got married b'shogeg, remember that the Shulchan Aruch said explicitly that even if her second marriage, her marriage before she had the proper chalitza or yibum was unintentional, was without realizing that she wasn't allowed to do it, without realizing what she was doing. So the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch was that she still has to get divorced. So the Bahag held that that's only if she doesn't have children. If there are already children in the picture, Shulchan Aruch did not pass. This way the Bahag is an earlier source than the Shulchan Aruch, and therefore the Bahag has the right to go. I mean, not the right. The Bahag didn't know the Shulchan Aruch even. It's like much, it's hundreds of years, centuries earlier. And therefore, what he says doesn't always fit with the Shulchan Aruch. So the Herzog is saying, and we have the right to file to, we have a support for leniency in the Bahag's position. If she already has children, then she should not get divorced. She doesn't need to get divorced after she had a chalitza. And then there were other authorities, not the most significant authorities, but important authorities, the Ra'avan and the Ramah, agreed with this heter of the Bahag if she had children. So you have a minority opinion. You have Rabbi Akiva Eiger as well, who also thought that if it's a really problematic situation, and it's a shot at the cock, meaning this poor woman is going to have to break up her marriage, and she's going to have to raise these children on her own, and this child on their own until she finds a husband, and it's going to be a terrible embarrassment to the family, and all the things that make it a terrible thing, Rabbi Akiva Eiger as well thought, Rabbi Akiva Eiger threw in, that you also don't know how the child's going to turn out, because if the child is thrust into this terrible situation of being called a mamzer derabanan and his parents didn't get divorced, it's all embarrassing, that might negatively affect, it might adversely affect the child's future. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger thought that there was room, therefore, to rely on this minority opinion. So that's step one. You have a minority opinion. Minority opinion starts with the Bahag, a very important authority. Others, authorities, not quite at the level of Bahag, but other important authorities like the Ravon and the Rambam agree. Rabbi Akiva Eiger felt it was something that could be relied upon in the case of a shat etchak, of a real problematic situation, and the Netziv in Meshiv Davar, who I think was also very much a makel on these kinds of, on lots of kinds of issues where it came to people doing the wrong thing, he also thought that you could be matir, we could allow them to stay together, and he added, even though the Bahag is basically a lone opinion, he says that's not quite true. That if you look in Rashi, now it's not clear that everybody agrees with the Netziv's reading of this Rashi. But the Netziv had a reading of a Rashi in Yevamot that the Netziv felt that she could stay with this husband, even if that the Netziv felt that Rashi held that she could stay with this husband, this man who she married when she shouldn't have, even if she didn't have children. So that was true. Then it would be all of a sudden it would be Rashi and the Bahag agreeing that she could stay with the second husband. That's a much stronger package of authorities that we had until now, because Rashi's really a very major authority. Now, another problem might be that we might think that we're not allowed to believe her, that she didn't know what she was doing. She says, I didn't know there was such a thing as Yibum. I didn't know I had to wait for a chalitza from the brother-in-law. So we might have thought, because in many situations we say, in Choshen Mishpat, the Shulchan Aruch says, that if witnesses see that somebody violated the Torah in a way that everybody knows that it's a sin, so that person who did that violation is already considered invalid for testimony. I mean, it's considered a rasha halachically. So that sounds like there are areas of halacha where even if you don't warn somebody, we can assume that people know about it. So you would have thought yibum and chalitza are written in the Torah. She should certainly know. So how could she argue that she doesn't know that if a woman's husband passes away without children, that she needs some ceremony before she can get married? So the answer is, it says, Rav Herzog, that depends on the situation. Even back then, meaning in the time of the Shulchan Aruch, if they saw somebody who was tying and unloosing a tie on Shabbos, they said that there they agreed that the person is not automatically rendered invalid as a witness. We don't treat him as a rasha, as a willful evildoer, unless they told him that that's Chilul Shabbos, meaning that even when it came to Chilul Shabbos, to violating Shabbat, which is a very serious issue, that they already, even in the 1500s, had certain areas of Shabbos violation where they imagined to themselves and they assumed that not everybody knew what was going on. And by virtue of not everybody knowing what was going on, that left room to say he was a shogig and not a mason. If you're a shogig, if you're doing it unintentionally, that doesn't invalidate you as a witness. So in Holland, says Rav Herzog, nobody knows anything. He says, you don't realize, the Shulchan Aruch never could have imagined the level of ignorance there is in Holland, that most of them, our understanding is, and the situation seems to be, they don't know anything. And they even don't know about Yibum, even if it's explicit in the Torah. And the woman herself says, I had no idea. Now that gets into another halakhic sugya, because the Gemara does talk about what's called an Omer Mutar. An Omer Mutar is somebody who says, I thought that was allowed. Right? That's exactly our situation here. I never knew it was us, or I thought it was allowed for whatever reason. So an Omer Mutar, the Gemara talks about, they have a debate in the Gemara between Rav and Abaye. Rav thinks that Omer Mutar is called Karov LeMezid. It's not quite intentional, but it's very close to intentional, because Rav thought that people are supposed to know halakha. So somebody says, I thought it was allowed, and it's not, particularly for things that are written explicitly in the Torah, that you might think that such a person is not really believed, they're not fully in text, but they don't qualify as a shogeg either. If that were true of her, then we wouldn't really be able to qualify her as a shogeg in saying that she got married not realizing, because we wouldn't believe her. But, says Rav Herzog, the Tosos there already say that in terms of an Omer Mutar, you see that the Gemara has a special pasuk to tell you that if somebody kills somebody and is an Omer Mutar in that situation, that you had a special pasuk to tell you that that killer cannot go to an Ir Mikla, cannot go to a city of refuge, meaning doesn't count as a shogeg. But that implies, says Tosfos, that other people are Omer Mutar, we really hold they are a shogeg, so maybe we don't follow Rava in this situation. The Taz and Yorah, this, he seems to accept that as well, as does the Beit Shmuel, and therefore you might have thought that Omer Mutar, and we should think that Omer Mutar really does come out as a shogeg. And not only that, says Rav Herzog, even if you want to say it's Karol Amazi, it's almost like being intentional. It's not quite intentional. It's not actually intentional. And since here, the whole idea that she can't stay married to the man she married was Dirabanan is rabbinic, that would be another reason to be making. So step number one is that she has children. We have a child that's about to come out. That you have the Bahag and maybe Rashi that says she can stay with the husband if she's already married and she has a child. Step number two is she's at least a shogeget, even though it's a thing that's explicit in the Torah. Holland has such lack of knowledge at the time among the Jews of the time that we can trust her that she didn't know about it. And then you say, well, but that only makes her an Omer Mutar. But we have evidence that an Omer Mutar should be considered, at least on rabbinic issues, an Omer Mutar can be considered unwitting and unintentional. Especially since, says Rav Herzog, when the whole discussions of Omer Mutar that we have were in situations where you had lots of rabbis around. So since you had rabbis around, people would go to shul on Shabbos, and they would hear the Torah being read, and very often it was translated into their language, and people knew that things that were explicit in the Torah, people, there was general knowledge of what was biblical, what's in the Bible. But nowadays, says Rav Herzog, especially in Holland, it's not true. And therefore, he doesn't think you can even qualify as Kruvah LeMezid as being close to intentional, because we have every reason to think that she has no idea, especially since it's not so common. Thank God. You don't have so many men passing away childlessly such that the wife has to have a chalitza or a yibum, which is a great thing, but it supports her claim that she had no idea that there was such a thing, that when she got married, she did not think she was doing anything wrong. Rav Herzog says she's like a Tinok Shadishpa in this way, meaning even if she's connected to Jewish observance, but if there's a form of Jewish observance that nobody knows about, so that would be like a Tinok Shadishpa in that they live in an environment where that thing just never comes up in halach, nobody ever knows about it, and maybe that would qualify as a Tinok Shadishpa. And you say, even in the Gemara, you find situations where people were so embedded in a culture that they didn't know what was going on, they didn't know the halacha and things like that, because you have a situation the Gemara in Chulin tells about when Rav came to certain places in Bavel early in his career. Rav moves from Eretz Yisrael, he's a student in Eretz Yisrael, that's why he's treated sometimes like a Tana, like a rabbi of the Mishnah. And he moves to Bavel at some point in his career, and he comes to a place called Tatalfush, and when he gets there, he finds out that the women didn't know anything about Basar Bechala. They didn't know anything about the prohibition of eating meat and milk together. I have to say, I recently, on Tzom Gedalia, was somewhere, and I went to visit Orthodox people, an Orthodox couple, for whatever reason, and they offered me food and drink. And it was very clear, and I said, no, thank you, and I didn't make a big deal of it, but it was very clear in the way they were asking that they didn't, it's not that they weren't themselves fasting. You know, it was, they didn't even know that it was a fasting anyway whatsoever, and these are observant people. Like, I'm not talking about, so that's the kind of thing that the Rav Herzog is saying. So if you can have, unfortunately and sadly, you can have situations where people, even observant people, really know what's going on. He's saying in Holland, that was the situation, and the lack of rabbinic leadership makes it a situation, and it means that it's perfectly plausible that she had no idea what was going on. If she has no idea what was going on, she's really a shogeget, and if she's really a shogeget, she's really, really violated unintentionally, so the Omer Mutar part of it doesn't make her like a mezida, like she's doing it intentionally or deliberately. It leaves her as not really what she's done, and if that's where she is, so then there's room to say that because this whole prohibition of her staying with her son was rabbinic anyway, there's room to say that we would allow her in these situations to rely on the leniencies that we've already seen in the Bahag and in Rashi. To give another example of the kinds of things that people might not even know, he says, if you look in Ezra, the book of Ezra, the simple reading of the text there is that people didn't know that you weren't allowed to marry non-Jews. Meaning, and this Sadly, today we can imagine it. If you said to a random Jew in America today, "Is Judaism does the Torah allow intermarriage?" Does the Torah explicitly prohibit intermarriage? I can easily imagine certainly Jews who are unaffiliated, possibly many Reform or even perhaps some conservative Jews who might say, "You know, my parents didn't like it that much. My parents would be upset if I ever did it." But if you said to them, "No, is it explicit? Is it?" disallowed by the Torah, I think that it's likely that many wouldn't. So in the time of Ezra, that's fairly clear, because Ezra and Nehemiah have to work hard to separate the people from their spouses, their non-Jewish spouses, who they had allowed themselves to take. And then it's also true there that in the simplest reading of the Pesukim is they also didn't know about the holiday of Sukkot until they heard it read from the Torah. Ezra establishes there a public Torah reading with Levim translating the Torah, and it seems to be only then that they realize that there is such a holiday. So this is another example for Herzog. I was saying that even the Gemara's time, they knew of such a thing as people who literally did not know that was explicit in the Torah, and they treated it as, literally did not know, they didn't treat it as Omer Mutar. Omer Mutar is, you know it's in the Torah, and you decide it's permissible anyway. That's not the same thing as we're talking about here. Like I was saying, not knowing about it at all, that's a whole new level. Now, a little bit of a counterweight to that would be that in Evan HaEzer, the Kufayin Chet, the Ramah, cites a Tshuvat Maharik. Maharik was asked about a woman who had committed adultery, but she thought it was okay. Meaning, you know, I remember from being a child in the 70s, there was this thing called swinging. So swingers were people who were happily married to each other, but they thought it was fine for them to meet up with another couple and spend the night together, each of them forgive them, and then they went off and stayed married to each other, and they were perfectly happy with each other. So, however that comes about, let's say you have a woman like that, a woman who thought that for whatever reason, she was allowed to have an affair with another man, to sleep with another man. Let's say her husband told her it was okay, right? So from the whole question, you see that in those times, there were people, and the Maharik's answer is not, well, she should have known better, and she clearly knew better, and she's like, or she's close to to deliberately having violated because she's an Omer Mutar. She's saying that it's allowed when it's really not allowed, and that's that category. It doesn't invoke that category, right? So even though, right, the prohibition of adultery is much clearer even in the Torah and much more better known in society in general, especially in non-Jewish society, that is the whole idea of Chalitza Yibum, right? So they knew about such a thing. They knew about the idea that people could completely not know of something. When that happened, they did not treat them as an Omer Mutar, as I think it's okay. I think it's okay as they know of the technical Isser, and they think this circumstance makes it okay for whatever reason. So therefore, you'd have to think that here too we can say that she doesn't qualify as an Omer Mutar. She's somebody who really, literally didn't know. But then, once we've mentioned this Ramon, this Maharik, sorry, we'll come to that in a second. In addition, he says, she also didn't know that there was a brother until recently. So, A, she didn't know there was such a thing as Chalitza, but she also didn't know there was a brother either, I think. And that makes her, Rav Herzog says, a complete shogeget. She really didn't know anything. And almost like an anusa, almost like it was beyond her abilities. She was forced into the situation because she had no knowledge of it. Meaning, let's suppose her husband, this is not what happened in this situation, but let's suppose her husband told her, I don't have any siblings. And then they get married and he dies. And then she, and in this case, let's say she knows everything, right? But she gets married, and then after she gets married, a man comes to town and proves in whatever way that he's actually the brother of the deceased husband. So that's an anusa, right? That's not a shogeget. It's completely out of her power. I think that would be an example of, it's completely out of her power. So Rav Herzog is saying here too, she didn't know there was a brother. She didn't know there was such a thing as chalitza. So this level of not knowing rises to the level of anusa, where it's completely beyond her powers. And in general, in halacha, when something is completely beyond one's powers and one does something because of that inability to do anything else, we don't count that against the person in any ways whatsoever. In addition, the whole idea that she has to separate from her husband is referred to as the Yesh Omrim in the Ramah. It's one opinion that's mentioned in the Ramah, but in this situation, you don't have to, and it's a Derabbanan issue, it's a rabbinic issue that fundamentally is rabbinic, you don't have to follow that Yesh Omrim. Perhaps you might have thought another fly in the ointment is that the Maharik's answer was that even though we treat the woman as a shogeget, it's not that we doubt her not realizing that it was prohibited. It's not that we treat her like close to be amazed, but he says, nonetheless, he thinks she cannot stay married to her husband. That's in the case of the woman who has an affair thinking it's okay, right? The husband says, you know what, I don't care. If you like that guy, go ahead, have a good time. And she goes and does it. Maharik says it doesn't matter because the Torah refers to adultery as umaalo bo maal. So we might usually translate the words as she like rebelled against him, and in this case she clearly didn't do that. But the Marik was telling us that no, when the Torah says ma'ala bo ma'al, that the woman betrayed her husband, it doesn't mean betrayed him like emotionally he'll be upset about it. It means betrayed him, she was with somebody else. And that violation of the exclusivity of the marital relationship is a ma'al, is a problem, and that creates a prohibition for them to stay married to each other, because that's halacha. And halacha, if a woman has an affair, she and her husband can't stay married. Not only can't she marry the adulterer after that, but she can't stay married to their first husband. The Marik's claim was, and this is what the Rama was agreeing to, was accepting, was that ma'alabo ma'al means that if she betrays the marital relationship, they cannot stay together. If that were true, then you might say the same thing here. Oh, and there it's a derabbanan, it's a prohibition, yet we're being machmir on it, we're being very stringent about it. Here too, it looks like she might be sort of married. In other words, rabbinically, they wanted her to think of the fact that she needed a yibum to mean that she's sort of like married until she gets a chalitza, and therefore her marrying somebody else is sort of a betrayal of that yibum relationship that should have been either taking place or being nullified, so therefore we should maybe be just as stringent. But says Rav Herzog, no, I think that is appropriate for where it was said, but it's not here. That's only where there's an actual kiddushin. There's an actual connection being made by some ritual that was created that connection, even if that kiddushin is only valid on a rabbinic level. Because when Chazal made something, they made it on a Doraita level. But here, the death of the husband creates a need for her to do something with the brother, either a chalitza or a yibum, to have some kind of a ceremony. But no such ceremony has ever happened, such that we would be so stringent to say that even if she married somebody else, since it looks somewhat like she has betrayed the original relationship, therefore she has to split. Rav Herzog says, I don't think we have to go that far because they're not similar enough to require that. He has another discussion of the question of what's called ola liyibum. Right now she's married to somebody else, so she couldn't possibly have a yibum because she has this marriage to this second husband. So he goes through a whole thing that we don't have to get into, but his fundamental answer is that whole category of ola liyibum means when the first husband passed away, could she have had yibum? And that's the question. So that becomes an issue that's not really relevant to us, and therefore we'll leave that discussion for another time. But what about the fact that she doesn't actually have children? One of our main avenues of leniency was that we could rely on the Bahag, because the Bahag had said if there are children, we don't require them to separate. But here there aren't yet children. Maybe you could have said only if there are already children. But Rav Herzog says he doesn't see any reason why that's a nafkamina, because why that makes a difference, because the Bahag's whole worry was that if you force them to split and the child grows up with his blemish on his record or her record, so that's just as true of the baby that's just about to be born as it is of the children that were already born. And therefore, we have to assume this baby's going to be born healthily, since most women give birth to healthy babies, and the babies live at least for long enough to be considered people. And therefore, since it's all the Rabbanan anyway, he thinks that the Bahag must certainly have meant that you could include a pregnancy as well, especially since Rashi, who the Netziv held, said it was true even without children. That would help us out in here as well. Now, what about this baby? Is he going to be a mamzer derabanan? Right, that one is a possibility as well. So even though we're allowing her to live with a husband because we're saying that she's a shogeget, it's still true that in some halachic sense, she seems to have had something akin to an affair on the brother-in-law, who she theoretically should have either had yibum or definitely should have had chalitza with. So maybe you would have said it's like an affair, and therefore maybe the baby should be like a mamzer derabanan. It should be illegitimate at a rabbinic level. He says in the end there are a lot of rishonim who allow this baby and do not think of it as a mamzer. There's a rif, there's a ramah, there's a rabban, a rashba, and the Marishtam paskin like them, ruled according to them, and therefore we can say that the child is considered a full ordinary Jew who can marry anybody else that he wants to or she wants to, and you don't have to worry about it. So conclusion is, he thinks they do have to separate until the chalitza can be put together, because they're not allowed to stay married when she does in fact have a need for chalitza or yibum, but she can do the chalitza as soon as possible, meaning she doesn't have to wait till she has the baby, and she can do the chalitza as soon as they can get the yibum there, and so that's what they're trying to do, to get the yibum there to have the chalitza be done. But then, says Rav Herzog, after the chalitza, they will need to get married again. They'll need to have a full chuppah and kiddushin, like a full wedding, because until now, we're not sure what happens. Because at least on a rabbinic level, since Chazal were concerned that she had the chalitza or the yibum, it's possible, Chazal said, that her need for that chalitza or yibum is so pressing that we don't even allow this marriage to take effect. And Chazal have the ability to do that, and therefore they have to have a second wedding. But they can't make brachos of that wedding because we're not clear that they need it. It might only be a rabbinic thing, and therefore they don't make brachos. But they have the wedding. Yeah, he says maybe they can have the wedding without saying the Shem Hashem, without saying the name of God, and maybe they can do it that way. And he hopes that Hashem lets all of us, including him, as he's passing on these very important issues, have the clarity of vision to understand the right way to Paskin and to bring the Jewish people to the right conclusions. And he also hopes, as we all should, that Hashem protect us, that women no longer have a need, a chalitza liyibo, meaning that men don't die childless anymore, and there be shalom for the Jewish people, and we can hope for that as well. And that is a responsible day for the 27th of Cheshvan, Rav Herzog finding a way for a woman who got herself in trouble without realizing it to stay with her husband, to have her child with her husband, and to live a long and happy life, we hope, with this second husband after having gotten a chalitza as she needed it. Have a great day.